Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here back again David Sineau. He's clinical professor of finance at University of Illinois. And once a month, always on a Friday, is here. And we talk a little bit about personal finance and financial planning. Now, sometimes when Dave is here, he starts out by talking about the economy. Or sometimes he talks about some particular aspect of financial planning. And this time around, he says he wanted to do something just a little bit different, although it's certainly related. As we know, one of the biggest worries a lot of people have is healthcare. And so that's a significant thing to keep in mind as you're thinking about financial planning. So he was interested in talking a little bit about that to start. And then we can take questions. I guess I'd hope people would understand that we can't solve the problems of the healthcare system, nor can we really debate why it is the way it is. Maybe the focus here should be a little bit of accepting conditions on the ground as they are and kind of going from there. So we'll see what Dave had to say. And, of course, then if you have questions about that or anything else that has to do with money management, you're welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, it's the day after. Everyone can hopefully breathe a sigh of relief that their 2003 income taxes have been paid in full. David, I presume that you're well taken care of. You've supported several people in the country. And while we could visit about rising interest rates, income taxes, perhaps 300,000 jobs apparently created in March, and the specter of increasing inflation, I thought I'd take a few minutes this morning and address one area of our economy that continues to grow profoundly in terms of the dollar amount of goods and services produced, and that is the medical sector of our economy. Let's put this in perspective. The U.S. gross domestic product now exceeds $10 trillion. Now, that's the sum of all goods and services produced in the United States. Our medical sector alone approximates 15% of this GDP number, or $1.5 trillion. Obviously, a bunch of fundamental questions arise. For example, how do we access medical care? Where's the money spent? Why is medical care so expensive? And really, how does this all impact on our retirement decisions and our financial planning decisions? Obviously, there are a number of ways people access medical care and, of course, a number of choices and programs. Most people over age 65 access their medical care through Medicare. Parts A and Parts B. We know that A is hospitals, B is doctors. Doctors, Part B, is an elective system. So if you want to elect that type of coverage, it's going to cost you about $65 a month if you're over age 65. Typically, premiums are paid through your Social Security. And the primary source of pay, once you are age 65, when you access medical care in the United States, is indeed Medicare. Now, you might have a backup insurance product known as Medigap, often sold by traditional insurance companies. The AARP offers any number of policies. This is meant to fill in the gaps, if you will, where Medicare doesn't provide doctor and hospital services. Under Medicare, what's not covered? Dental, hearing aids, and at least today, no drugs. That's going to change, and that's going to cost billions more, but we're going to have to stay tuned to the impact of that program really commencing in 2006. Currently, we spend approximately $275 billion a year, and we, the government, that's us, $275 billion a year in Medicare payments. And it, of course, is going up each day that we sit here. Now, if you're really poor, if you're not even part of the working poor, but you are really poor, you would be covered by something called Medicaid. And Medicaid is often misunderstood. In a nutshell, it is a jointly sponsored federal and state program. The rules of coverage are set by the state, but the federal government also contributes for every dollar the state puts into the program to cover these poor folks, then the federal government does likewise. And also, the program covers long-term nursing home care for the financially indigent. That makes up a big number of these Medicaid dollars. The cost between state and federal programming is now in excess of $300 billion per year. And just as a sidelight, if we note, Social Security payments in this country are now approximating $500 billion per year. Now, there are other entry points into the healthcare system. For example, if you're a veteran, maybe you're part of the Veterans Health System, which is a system of doctors and hospitals throughout the country for veterans. Interestingly enough, it is estimated that 50% of our veterans who currently use this system are projected to die over the next 10 years. A lot of World War II veterans, a lot of Korean War veterans. One of the reasons that veterans use the VA system is because drugs are free. Remember, we don't have Medicare coverage for drugs at the current time, and that's why so many people use the VA for drug access. But as more and more veterans unfortunately pass away in our country, there is going to be a continued effort, indeed this effort is taking place now, to fold, if you will, the VA system into the Medicare system. And there is an attempt to push more and more people into Medicare, especially by the year 2006, when you're going to have this partial drug coverage. There are other access points into the medical system, for example. There are free health care systems for some unfortunate people, the Shriners Hospitals, free clinics, miscellaneous programs. Students, for example, at the University of Illinois have a university health care system, as they do throughout the country. However, most people in this country procure their insurance as a result of their employment. So if you are not part of the working poor, if you are not employed, and if you're not under 65 or even self-employed, you may not even have health insurance. And that number is estimated to be approximately 40 million people in this country. And where do those folks access medical care? In emergency rooms. And when you go to an emergency room, it's one of the most expensive places to access medical care. These are people who typically cannot afford or pay for the medical care. And these costs then are passed on, if you will, to everyone else through their insurance premiums. Now, when you work for a company or an institution, hopefully you have a menu of choices that your employer will offer you to access medical care. If the premiums are paid by the employer, then that premium in a profit organization is deductible to the employer. It's a necessary and ordinary business expense, just like a pension plan, just like a 401k plan, or any other benefit or salary benefit that you receive. And it is not taxable to you. So that's a benefit. When your employer pays that premium is not part of your taxable income. One choice, of course, is traditional indemnity insurance. And the characteristics of a traditional indemnity insurance program, like a Blue Cross, Blue Shield program, a Travelers program, you name it, handled by many, many major insurers in this country, you have unlimited doctor choice, you have unlimited hospital choice, which, of course, is the major benefit of a traditional indemnity insurance program. You might have a deductible. You probably do, as a matter of fact, just like your automobile deductible. You're going to have to pay the first dollars, maybe $250, maybe even the first $500 of a medical claim. And in addition, there will be coinsurance provisions. And that is that if you have a severe medical situation, which is in excess of the deductible, you're going to have to pay some additional amount, some ceiling, maybe up to $1,000, $1,500 as a coinsurance payment. And then, of course, the insurance company picks up the rest. Now, another choice, which has become widely popular, especially over the last 10 or 15 years, even though it's subject to major criticism, is managed care. Now, managed care, in a nutshell, is really a system in which the medical care is prepaid, often by your employer. And the healthcare providers, the doctors, the hospitals, the drugstores, the druggists, the rehabilitation centers, etc., are obligated, if you will, to provide medical care for you if you are indeed part of this prepaid census. And the most common type of managed care programs that we all know about are HMOs. And interestingly enough, I wanted to point this out. The genesis of the HMOs, the health maintenance organizations, actually started with Henry Kaiser of Kaiser Steel in California. When Henry Kaiser was a very young man, his mother became seriously ill, and they were a very poor family. And because of their poverty and their lack of access to medical care, interestingly enough, Mrs. Kaiser actually died from lack of medical care. And Henry Kaiser, as a child, vowed that if he ever became successful ever became a business employer, if you will, he was going to be darn sure that his employees were going to have access to quality medical care. And indeed, he kept his promise through the Kaiser HMO program, which eventually became Kaiser Permanente, which is the largest health maintenance organization in the United States. And of course, an HMO is really nothing more than an administration contracting with a series of doctors, probably a series of hospitals, druggists, rehabilitation centers, to provide you all of the medical services that you need. There are many advantages of an HMO: no paperwork, no bills to hassle with, like a traditional insurance program, typically no deductibles, and less expensive. Often your employer will pay the entire premium if you opt into an HMO program. The major disadvantage, of course, is that your doctor choice is limited and your hospital choice is limited. Now, in Champaign-Urbana, in this community where we live, we are blessed with a plethora of wonderful doctors and wonderful hospitals and wonderful choices. But in a lot of areas, it's a lot different situation if you are part of an HMO. Also, you've got to access your medical care through a primary care physician, often referred to as a gatekeeper. And access, therefore, is often limited through this gatekeeper system and really through a system of copays. If you walk in and you get medical care, you typically have to write a small check, maybe $10, $15, $20 as part of a copay. And if you're injured outside of your HMO area, you have to report back to your HMO other than for emergency care, because if you continue treatment after emergency, you may have to pay for it yourself. So if you go outside of your area for non-emergency treatment, indeed, you might have to pay. But HMOs are great if you are healthy. It makes a lot of sense for younger people who are indeed healthy. Now, a byproduct of the HMO system, which again is often misunderstood, is something called a PPO, a preferred provider organization, which is really sort of an HMO with an option to go outside of your network for medical treatment. So typically, if you have the normal things and you're very happy with your HMO, but suddenly you develop a very debilitating illness and you feel more comfortable going to some other hospital, some other doctor, then you have that option. However, you will end up paying 20 to 30% of that bill, and your HMO then picks up maybe 60, 70, perhaps 80%, depending upon the contract. And indeed, the premiums are more expensive, and indeed, your employer may require you to contribute. Well, David and I were just talking before the program off the air that even someone our ages, and we're relatively young, that our families and just normal medical care can cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a year. And it's just a very, very expensive business. And how fortunate we are and how fortunate people are if you work for an employer who basically pays your premium, even though you may have to pay premiums on your spouses and your children, by virtue of being a larger group, even that premium cost is inexpensive. And this becomes a major problem for people who are self-employed, who retire early and then may be faced before they are 65 with paying for their own health coverage. Indeed, many Americans continue to work until age 65 because of these costs. It would not be unusual for a family of four to be facing medical premiums of $10,000 plus per year between ages 59 and 65. It's not unusual at all, and it forces people to stay in the workforce. And these folks who are thinking of retiring at 59, 60, 61, and 62 are saying, retirement looks pretty good, but for my cost of health care. At the same time, major employers in major companies are cutting back health care benefits for retired individuals, even though these retirees believed when they retired that they were going to be covered at least until age 65. That's not happening. Imagine if you're with a company like Enron. Imagine if you're a company that went through one of these major corporate bankruptcies and you had relied on health care. That's a terrible planning problem and retirement problem. Well, why is healthcare so expensive? Why does it really consume about 15% of our GDP? Here are some very interesting statistics. Obviously, it's no surprise that we have a very aging population in this country. Here's the interesting statistic. 50% of all medical bills that we will incur in our lifetime are going to be incurred in the last year of our life. So you think of all the money that you've spent on medical care today, and then figure that half is going to be spent again in your last year of life. 5% of our population consume 50% of all the medical goods and services provided in this country. And very frankly, that typically is by our elderly population. Not everybody, but by and large measure. Something else that is operating in this country, unlike other countries, and that is the concept of entitlement. I don't think there is anyone in this country who doesn't feel that they are entitled to the optimum medical care that is available in this country. And optimum medical care is expensive. It almost seems like medical care is a right as opposed to a privilege. I don't remember reading about it in the Constitution, but it is ingrained typically in all of us that we have the right to the best medical care possible. Technology, changes in technology, obviously have made things more expensive. Medical malpractice suits, unfortunately, have made things more expensive for doctors who have wildly expensive medical malpractice insurance premiums, well in excess of $100,000 for many of them. The cost of drugs, the cost of development, the strong lobby of the drug industry in the United States, and the relationship with the FDA and with Congress probably has had a lot to do with the costs of those drugs as compared to other countries. And, of course, we have a substantial number of people in our population, a very substantial part of our population, which frankly engages in unhealthy activities, whether it's drugs, whether it's violence. And unfortunately, these people typically are not insured. They end up in ERs, just like the TV show. They end up in ERs, and delivery of those medical services is extremely expensive. Even for folks on Medicaid, if they go to a hospital cannot turn down medically treating a Medicaid patient. I want you to visualize in your mind, just for a moment, an equilateral triangle. Each triangle corner obviously has 60 degrees. So you just think about this triangle, an equilateral triangle in your mind. At the very top of the triangle, the north end of the triangle, write cost. Cost is at the very top. At the bottom left angle of the triangle, put quality. And in the bottom right end of the triangle, put access. And then draw arrows going north. And that is that as you increase access to the system, you increase cost. As you increase the quality of the medical care, you increase cost. And that's known as the medical triangle. Access and quality mean higher cost to medicine. Now, we hear about other countries. Oh, we're covered for our entire life and medical care is very, very good. Well, let's be real straight and honest about this, and let's talk about the concept of rationing, which already exists in most other countries. Take Canada, for example. I'm 85 years of age in Canada and I need dialysis. Guess what? I don't get it unless I can pay for it myself because the Canadian government and its citizens have made a decision that, hey, if I'm 85 and I can't pay for dialysis, well, you've lived to 85 and hopefully you've had a good life and you've essentially been issued a death sentence. That's the bottom line. If I'm 85 in the United States and I want dialysis, my goodness, I'm going to get dialysis. That is the fundamental difference. That even though we have some senses of rationing through co-insurance and co-payments, the bottom line is that we still have access and quality. And unfortunately, for many people who don't have continuous medical coverage, this has a tremendous impact on their retirement planning. And right now, there just is not a really good system, if you will, that is in place in this country to deal with people who've had a reasonably good life, have been saving for retirement, and wish to retire before age 65, but then are faced with this enormity of these insurance premiums. So I think it's a problem that's going to be picked up, not this year, but I think we're going to hear a lot more about this after the elections, after hopefully things in Iraq have some kind of conclusion. but it's a major problem. It's just sort of been on the back burner for the last year, year and a half. But we can't continue to consume more and more of our gross domestic product in this one area. 15% is a very large number. So, David, I'd be happy to talk about these issues. I'm happy to talk about interest rates. I think there's some very important information about interest rates our listeners need to be cognizant of, inflation, the economy, et cetera, or any other financial planning topics we'd like to visit about.
All right. Our guest, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at University of Illinois once a month. Always on a Friday is here. We talk about financial planning, money management, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign to start off with on line one.
Good morning.
Good morning,
I
sir.
I have a couple of questions which actually happen to do with insurance. As a university faculty member, I'm sure you got the same thing that I did as a staff member, which was a mass mailing dated this last April 13th, which was titled Amendment to State of Illinois Benefits Plan and Changes to Benefit in the Choice Enrollment Books. And the bulleted item was a Medicare policy clarification, which says members or dependents who retired and or turned age 65 after July 1st and who are not eligible for premium-free Medicare Part A, et cetera, et cetera. As I understood it, that was saying that CSRS retirees who did not pay into the Medicare plan have to be certified by Medicare to get CSRS medical coverage. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not an expert on it. I read it. The same thing that you read, and I really don't have an opinion on it. I think you are best to take that up with CSRS and your counselor. I think my understanding is that we may end up for people who do not pay into the Medicare system, and now, of course, everyone is paying into the Medicare system, that you might have to pay some premium. I think that's what we're talking about here. There might be a premium cost.
I have never paid into it since I started with the university, and I'm still not paying into it, and I don't expect to. Anyway, the other one was also an insurance question, and that is, do you have any good rule of thumb about how much personal umbrella liability coverage one should have? Like, is there a relationship between the amount of umbrella coverage and your net worth or so on?
Well, I think in a nutshell that if you have any type of net worth at all, and what I'm talking about there is between $500,000 and $1 million, and it's surprising how fast that can add up. One should carry a minimum of $1 million of umbrella, but most of my clients, I recommend carrying a minimum of $2 million of umbrella liability in addition to $500,000 of primary coverage. So that will cover your automobile exposures and your homeowner exposures. If you are a real estate investor, however, and you own multifamily units or you own shopping centers, etc., then typically you would be looking at a $10 billion umbrella liability policy.
All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Right. Thank you. Let's go to have somebody on cell phone. This will be line number three. Hello.
David, I want to thank you for a very comprehensive and succinct coverage of the healthcare system. One of the items that I wish you would discuss that you didn't mention was a relatively new type of healthcare policy, the medical savings accounts.
Actually, the medical savings accounts have been around for a long time, and it really is a means by which you can essentially pay for your own medical care with pre-tax dollars. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yes.
Yes. Do you have such a plan?
Pardon?
Do you have such
a
plan?
I don't have such a plan. I have a friend over in the East St. Louis area who is really working to promote these and get people to understand them better. And it for healthy people, it's one way of really keeping down the cost of their medical care.
Exactly. Now, these are tax-approved plans. These are IRS-sponsored plans. You typically can work with people who specialize in these areas. In fact, there are even insurance agencies who specialize in medical savings accounts. And it is a way in which you can take funds from your salary or your self-employment, set up your own program, and get a tax deduction because, unfortunately, for those of us who itemize on our tax returns, it's pretty darn difficult to meet that 7.5% of adjusted gross income on our medical expenses. And as a result, this is a system by which we can actually take dollars and put them into our own account, pay them out, and get a tax deduction for them. These are often in conjunction, however. These medical savings accounts are often bought in conjunction with a major medical policy, the major medical policy, so that in the event that you run into a major or catastrophic event, you have a substantial policy subject to a deductible which will then cover, if you will, this major catastrophic event. And by covering the first several dollars or the first $1,000 or $2,000 or even up to $5,000, these policies become far more affordable. But again, you need to work with a financial advisor who is a specialist in this area or certain insurance folks who specialize in MSAs or medical savings accounts. And, sir, your point is well taken.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Maybe I should reintroduce our guest. We're talking with David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois. And for a long time now, he's been with us every month, always on a Friday, to talk about financial planning and money management. And here at the beginning, he was talking just a little bit about cost of health care. So if you have questions about how it is you work that into your financial plan, I know that he will do his best to help you out. But as he said, if you have questions on anything else, you want to talk about interest rates, you want to talk about mutual funds, you know, anything, the kinds of things we always do on the show, of course, any and all of that's welcome. And I know he'll do his best to help you out.
You know, David, we've been doing this for a long time. It's sort of funny. I think it began when my children were in about third or fourth grade. Now they're starting
college
now. Yeah, now they're starting to graduate college. So I don't know if that dates us, David, or what.
I prefer not to think about it.
All right.
Let's go to a caller here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah. In terms of, you mentioned interest, it seems to me that we're going to come into, I would think, quite a bit of inflation, especially the deficit spending that's going on here. And when do you think this is going to occur? How far are we off from that?
Well, I think you've hit a very important point. Look, we're spending $2.5 trillion at the federal level. We're taking in somewhere between $1.8 and $1.9 trillion. That's a $600 billion deficit. It looks like it's going to expand with the monies that we are spending abroad. Our economy, while it seems to be picking up, the job growth hasn't been there, so we don't have the dollars pouring into the Treasury like we should. We've already seen growth in certain sectors of the economy. Last month, for the first time, we did see a pickup in jobs of some 300,000, if we can believe that report. But more troubling is we're seeing the cost of basic commodities for the first time really picking up, not only at the wholesale level, but at the production level. And whether we're talking about the cost of oil or whether we're talking about the cost of foodstuffs, I don't think we have to look any further than $10 a bushel beans to see that we've got some major pressures that are building at the production level in this country. When we've got major production level pressures building, that is going to translate into inflation not only at the wholesale level, but at the retail level. Last month, we saw the CPI go up by over 0.5%. So we're seeing movements for the first time, meaningful, even though they are volatile up and down, meaningful movements in the consumer price index. And when we see this type of deficit spending, when we see these kinds of movements at the wholesale level, I think that we're going to see higher interest rates. Already, mortgage rates have moved up. So we've got now 30-year mortgages over 6%. It's been some time since we've seen 30-year mortgages at 6%. They weren't too long ago when they were at 5%. We have the 10-year Treasury instrument that a couple of months ago was hovering in the 3.5% to 3.6% range is now hovering at the 4.4% range. That's a dramatic increase. So as a result, we're going to see higher interest rates, and as long as we have these budget deficits, we've got, what, a national debt of $7.7 trillion. We're going to add to that by leaps and bounds of hundreds of billions of dollars. The government itself is bidding up the cost of money. They've got to make their treasuries attractive enough to all of us and to foreign buyers to continue to buy those treasuries so we can continue to deficit spend. How do you make those treasuries popular among us as buyers? How do you make us give us the impetus, if you will, to buy them? You've got to offer an attractive interest rate. That's what you really have to do. So the market is already bidding this up. Without the help of Alan Greenspan, who's sitting there at a 1% Fed funds rate, or at least a 1% target Fed funds rate, the market is doing his bidding already and is bidding these interest rates up. So that doesn't bode well. What does that mean? It means it's going to cost me more to buy a car if I'm going to finance it. If I'm going to buy real estate, it's going to cost me more if I'm going to finance it. In fact, everything is going to cost more. So we've got inflation, we've got interest rates, and I don't think that bodes well. Now, it's not today, it's not tomorrow, but again, it's starting to show. And what I would suggest is for folks who are in long-term fixed income instruments. Now, I harped on this for many months, but now I'm even harping on it more. If you are in a mutual fund, which has got an average of 20-year, 25-year treasuries or fixed income instruments, it's time to shorten your maturities. Do not go out and chase yields at the moment, because yields are going to start to inexorably move up. So, yes, I'm concerned about inflation, and I'm concerned about interest rates.
Well, also, the other one is that I hope they don't, in terms of this tax cut, I hope that's not extended. That's going to be a terrible impact, too, over the long run if they do that extension.
You know, it's very interesting. I saw a CNN poll, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, which had a margin of error of 4 or 5% when asking American citizens, would you prefer to not spend so much, or would you prefer to cut taxes? They would say, hey, don't cut the taxes. Let's continue to spend and don't cut the taxes. They're more concerned about delivering services to the American citizens than cutting taxes. So your point is well taken.
Well, the other one is the difficulty with the current administration is that they're not too big on the services, you know what I mean, to the public.
Well, I guess we could argue about that. The current administration or Congress or whomever it is, I sort of group everybody together.
Right. But, I mean,
we're spending a heck of a lot of money.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's continue. I think the next caller here would be on line number one, and they are in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I had a question about life insurance.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you had an opinion, a group term versus individual term, such as kind of like the U of I,
mm-hmm.
Is there an advantage one way or the other?
Well, remember, when you have a group term product, when you buy a group term product, typically when you leave the group, that's the end of the term product.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then if you wanted to continue that product, while you might have the option to continue that product, you are then reconfigured into an individual census as opposed to a group census.
Uh-huh.
So that premium can jump dramatically. Now, if you are simply in need of term life insurance during the period that you are employed at the University of Illinois, for example, and you don't see the need for additional life insurance at the time that you may retire or leave the institution, then by all means, you can continue to buy additional amounts of group term through the programs offered at the university. And the only thing I would do is compare. And that is that if I can buy it at 10 cents per dollar or 2 cents per dollar, whatever it is through the university, I would just simply compare it with private pay.
Would you recommend having that more as a supplement as opposed to primary, your primary source of life insurance?
Yes. Yes. Now, if you're going to have a primary coverage, it brings up a whole lot of other questions, and that is, what is the appropriate life insurance product for you?
Uh-huh.
And, for example, I, of course, have counseled people. I like level term products where I can buy a life insurance product for a level term, perhaps 10 or 20 years. I own some myself. And I also own some ordinary or whole life insurance, which provides you other types of opportunities. While it is not, I don't believe you buy that as an investment. You can buy it for a number of reasons. You can access cash values, and it may indeed be an estate planning technique where you can roll those dollars over into something called a crummy trust. So these are issues that need to be carefully thought out in concert with your financial advisor.
Okay. And generally, how long do you need it? Like, if by the time all your kids are out?
By the time all your kids are out and your debts are paid, then if you do not need life insurance for a business purpose, like a buy-sell plan, or for an estate purpose, then one has to question whether you want to spend additional dollars for life insurance. And then the other thing I counsel people is don't buy too much life insurance on your children. You're a heck of a lot more likely, or I'm a heck of a lot more likely to die than my children. So it doesn't do my children a whole lot of good to have a lot of life insurance if I die, and I don't have a lot of life insurance on my life. So I'm a great believer that those dollars should be more allocated to the parents as opposed to the children. And furthermore, when it comes to life insurance, let's not forget about disability insurance. People who are employed in white-collar positions are 15 times more likely to become disabled than they are to die. So one has to look at that allocation between how much should I be spending on disability insurance versus what I should be spending on life insurance. So the question becomes, if I'm disabled, what types of dollars are going to be coming in on a monthly basis? Now, you may be part of the university disability program or the supplemental disability program. So that is certainly as large an issue as the life insurance issue.
Okay. And one last thing is generally how much? I know there are a lot of different calculations, but how much does one usually need for life insurance?
Well, without children,
uh-huh.
10 times
okay.
your income.
Okay.
With children, 15 times.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Next is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm rapidly approaching the 70 and a half years for withdrawal from my IRA.
Yes.
And it's a regular IRA.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, I have heard that IRAs are a pain in the neck for your heirs, and I'm thinking that in times when I want to withdraw money, should I withdraw it from my IRA with the idea of depleting that first before I would liquidate any other kind of investments?
Well, that's really a great question. Number one, IRAs really shouldn't be a pain in the neck.
To inherit.
And the reason is because in your IRA, you name beneficiaries.
Right.
And that IRA passes by operation of law. So from an estate process or a probate process, it's one of the easiest things to pass. It does not go through your estate unless your beneficiary is named as your estate. But for example, if I have an IRA and I name my wife Carol as the beneficiary of my IRA, and unfortunately I die, Carol receives it automatically. Now, if you are married, are you married?
No.
Okay. Let me just cover that case first. If you are married and your spouse receives your IRA as a result of a death, number one, there are no estate taxes and there are no income taxes, and that is simply what is referred to as a spousal IRA. In your case, where maybe you are leaving your IRA or you have beneficiaries, our children, for example,
right.
All right, they will have a number of choices which they can exercise. The first choice is, give me my money. I want all my money up front. And if whatever money they take, they will pay income tax. And your estate, depending upon its size, may also be subject to estate tax. But of course, right now, estates have to be in excess of $1.5 million.
Unless I die on that magic 10 years.
Well, yeah, hopefully you'll live a lot longer. You sound pretty young for 70 and a half, at least over the radio. So in other words, unless you have a very substantial estate, and because that number is going to go up to $3 to $3.5 million, it's unlikely there would be any estate tax.
Right.
So now we have income tax.
Right.
The children can also opt for a 5-year payout. All right?
Okay.
And that the December following the year in which you would pass away, the children would have to take 1/5, then 1/4, 1/3, 1/2, 1/1. So that will ameliorate the impact of income taxes. And it may well also be that they will have the option of taking it over their lifetime as an inherited IRA based upon their life expectancy. So to further ameliorate the impact of federal income tax. So I think they have some good options. I think it's a great program. And remember that those monies continue to grow tax deferred to the extent you don't access them. And under the new distribution rules, which are really very flexible and better rules than the old rules for you as the recipient of your own IRA funds, you really have to take out very, very little starting at age 70 and a half. It's something like 1/26th or 1/25th of the total amount in there. So if you had $100,000, let's say, in your IRA, you might in the first year have to take out as little as $4,000 out of that IRA and pay tax on it. Not too burdensome.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
We have somebody who asked a question off the air, and I think I will want to get it in here. Hopefully it won't be too complicated to deal with. They would just like to know, what is the difference between a money market account and a short-term bond account?
Okay. A money market account maintains a dollar-for-dollar share value. Money markets typically invest in financial instruments that mature in 29 days or less. So they might be in very, very short-term U.S. Treasury instruments, or more likely, short-term certificates of deposit, or something we call commercial paper. And commercial paper is corporate IOU paper. So GMAC acceptance would be an example of commercial paper. And it's typically what is referred to as rolling 7-day commercial paper. So it's always maturing every 7 days. So there is instant liquidity, if you will, in a money market account. And you can even write checks often against your money market account. If you're in a mutual fund money market account, through a mutual fund, it is not insured. However, if you're at your bank with a money market account, that's simply a promise to pay from your bank. It's FDIC insured up to $100,000. And you can generally write checks against your money market account, typically 3 checks a month. Or for that matter, you could walk into the bank every day and you could do a transaction, either put more money into it or take money out of it with no penalty. That's a money market account. A short-term bond account or mutual fund bond account is something completely different. It is basically a compendium of bonds and often short-term fixed instruments that may have maturities anywhere from 3 months up to 2.5 years. And those bonds fluctuate in value every day based upon the direction of interest rates. So your share value may well indeed fluctuate every day. In addition, obviously, a money market account, a fixed income bond account, well, those instruments pay dividends. They pay interest. So you will be receiving dividends in the form of additional shares. But a bond fund is not insured. It does not try to maintain a dollar-for-dollar share value on a daily basis. And it quotes a price at the end of the day. And if you decide to liquidate, you will get the ending price, which is often referred to as the NAV or net asset value. In other words, what's the value of all the bonds? Divide that by the total number of shares, and that will give you the price per share. So it's a moving target. And if you're going to be in a bond fund, while interest rates are starting to move up, you want to make sure that the average maturity of that bond fund is relatively short. Maybe 2, 2.5, 3 years, something like that. Hope that helps out.
Clinton, Indiana, our next caller, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. So I have a question for you. I am 32 years old, and I work for a large company that for our retirement fund, it's profit share, which means they give me a portion of my salary back in company shares. I also have the option to contribute as well, and I do. But I have 2 choices. I can contribute into the regular profit share, which gives me, again, shares of the company I work for, or I can diversify and invest in different risk, kind of like mutual funds. Currently, I put all of my money back into the profit share because the company is doing very well, better than the general market. But my question for you is, am I doing the wrong thing by putting all of my retirement eggs in one basket?
You're doing the wrong thing. Clearly, you're doing the wrong thing, and whether it's IBM, AT&T, XYZ, the best company in the world, you are doing the wrong thing.
Okay.
I recommend no more than 10% of your entire profit-sharing program in company shares. Now, the shares that the company provides for you and just hands you these shares in your profit-sharing plan, do you have the ability to sell those shares?
I don't have the ability to sell those shares, I don't think, until I'm ready for retirement.
Okay. If that's the case, you make certain that all the other dollars that you are putting into your plan are going into a diversified portfolio of mutual funds starting today.
Okay.
All right?
Very good advice. That's an easy step for me to do. I just hadn't taken the plunge.
Okay.
I was afraid I wasn't doing the smart thing since the market isn't performing as well. I mean, the company's doing well right now.
You're taking something called unsystematic risk, the risk of holding one company. It's huge. Don't underestimate it, regardless of the quality of the company you are working for. Imagine those tens of thousands of people who thought Enron was the greatest company in the world. 90% of all profit-sharing monies in the Enron plan were in Enron stock. Those people basically ended up with nothing.
Yeah.
Don't let that happen to you.
Okay. Thank you for your advice. I appreciate your help.
All right. Thank you. Champagne is next. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good show. Could you discuss bubbles? They say part of the increase in cost of real estate is linked to fiat currencies, which are declining, and Soros bet against the British pound. But who was favoring the pound? Who buys the pounds? Thanks. We'll listen off air.
Okay. Is that beyond your...
That's beyond my scope, but let's talk about real estate bubbles in general. Okay. Obviously, real estate prices have moved higher both in single-family dwellings and multifamily-type units, and the major reason driving this is obviously low interest rates. Even cap rates. If you are a fixed-income investor, cap rates have been dropping. In other words, people are paying more as a function of the income that they can realize from a property, because they can finance these properties at a lower level. As far as the relationship that all has to pounds and dollars, et cetera, that simply is for a good, strong economist and is just beyond my purview. But it sounds like a wonderful question and something should be analyzed.
All right. And another caller here, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Perhaps you can give me some information in this regard to death and burial. My mother recently died, and I was the executor, and my stepfather had placed monies, I don't know how much or much of anything, in some kind of bank where when she was died, that money was transferred to the funeral home, and it paid the cost of everything, and what was left over was dispersed, you know, evenly among the people.
Yes.
I just wondered what kind of, I'll just call them instruments, what kind of instruments are there for, you know, since planning for your death and paying it for yourself, and is there a best way to go or anything
well,
like that?
Well, I'm not clear exactly what that instrument was. You know, a lot of instruments are called POD instruments. They're called paid on death.
Mm-hmm.
And you might have had some type of...
I ran across that in some CDs she had.
Yes, yes.
Which were taken care of. But this was...
This sounds like a prepaid burial plan.
Yeah, I meant where, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm, a prepaid burial program where your bank was an escrowee or a trustee.
Mm-hmm.
And that trustee had instructions that at her death to pay a certain amount out of that account,
mm-hmm.
if you will, almost like a custodial escrowed account,
mm-hmm.
to cover these burial inspections. So while I'm sorry that your mother passed away, it sounds like she was a good planner.
You know, almost my stepfather.
Or your stepfather. I'm sorry,
yeah,
while your stepfather passed away.
He had everything planned down to a T.
Well, it sure sounds like it.
Now, are there other instruments like that, or is this something you have to do with the bank and the funeral home? Or?
Well, usually a lot of people prepay their funeral expenses directly with the funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are concerned that the funeral home won't be around.
Yeah,
So that's a problem. So they arrange through a trustee at a bank with a specific dollar amount to transfer that at their death to the funeral home.
Now, you put in a lump sum?
Yeah, typically.
Draw interest off
mm-hmm.
that?
Sure, sure. And it's your money. Okay. It's your money, so you have the ability to access that money.
Okay. Are there plans, do you know, where you put in so much a month?
I don't. I think you would have to discuss that with your financial institution.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Right, thank you. Well, we're just about the point where you have to finish up here. Any last bit of wisdom that you'd like to leave with people this time around?
No, I was just... extraordinarily impressed with the breadth of telephone calls this morning and the questions. It's just so much fun to be here because some of them are challenging. I apologize to the people that I can't answer all of the questions, especially some of the economic questions, but it's always fun to try. And David, once again, I know that there is a pledge drive taking place, I believe, next week.
Starts tomorrow, as a matter of fact.
For starting tomorrow, and I certainly appreciate all of the listeners who support WILL. I can't think of a better thing to do with one's money and a more charitable purpose.